Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Trump is in Manchester, New Hampshire this hour. In any moment, he's expected to announce details of his administration's initiative to stop opioid abuse. Trump is speaking at Manchester Community College. This is his first return to the Granite State since being elected president. And we expect the president to begin speaking any moment now. We'll bring you his speech, and here he is.
Who has been so incredible. And we are blessed to have you as our First Lady. Really are. It's great to be back in the beautiful state of New Hampshire. I don't know if you remember, but this is the first place I came for the primaries yet. And this is the room right here. So I like this room. This has been a good room. We're honored to be joined by your wonderful and very talented governor, Chris Sununu. Chris, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Oh, and there's another talented governor. Governor Sununu, stand up. I have to tell you, there was nobody tougher on Trump at the beginning. It's true. There was nobody on television tougher. And then we met each other, and we liked each other, and he went from the worst to the best. Governor, thank you. I mean that, too. Thank you. I want to thank also Attorney General Sessions and Secretary, thank you, Jeff, Secretary Azar, Secretary Nielsen, and Surgeon General Adams for joining us at this very important event. The First Lady and I just visited the Manchester Fire Department Safe Station, talking about it all over the country. The Fire Chief, Dan Goonan, and all of the first responders with us today, thank you. You've been incredible, and you're saving American lives. We're also joined by a number of law enforcement officers who we love, our police, DEA, ICE, Border Patrol agents, and customs officers work night and day to keep drugs out of our communities and criminals off of our streets. So today we thank you. We honor you, and we want you to know that we will always have your backs 100%. Thank you very much, law enforcement. Thank you. I especially want to acknowledge all of the families with us today who have endured terrible hardships because of the opioid crisis, and especially those who have lost precious loved ones. I've been saying this for a long time. And it all started right here in New Hampshire, because I see what you're going through, about as bad as there is anywhere in the country. And I said I'd be back, and we are back, and we're pouring a lot of money and a lot of talent into this horrible problem. And we pledge to honor the memory of those you lost with action and determination and resolve. We'll get it. We will not rest until the end. And I will tell you, this scourge of drug addiction in America will stop. It will stop. Every day, 116 Americans die from an opioid-related overdose. In New Hampshire, the overdose, really, death rate. I mean, can you believe this? The death rate is double the national average. It's got difficulties like people wouldn't believe. Defeating this epidemic will require the commitment of every state, local, and federal agency. Failure is not an option. Addiction is not our future. We will liberate our country from this crisis. Never been like this. Hundreds of years, never been like this. And we will raise a drug-free generation of American children. Last October, we declared the opioid crisis a public health emergency. Should have been done a long time before. Since then, we've worked with Congress to ensure at least $6 billion additional dollars going through right now in new funding in 2018 and 2019 to combat the opioid crisis. And we will be spending the most money ever on the opioid crisis. On our most recent National Prescription Drug Take Back Day, people across the country turned in more than 900,000 pounds of unused or expired prescription drugs, more than the weight of three Boeing 757s. Our custom and border protection and these people, the job they do is incredible, seized nearly 1,500 pounds of fentanyl last year, nearly three times the amount seized in 2016. And I told China, don't send it. And I told Mexico, don't send it. Don't send it. In 2017, ICE arrested criminal aliens with 76,000 charges and convictions for dangerous drug crimes. Last year, the Department of Justice prosecuted more than 3,000 defendants in cases involving opioid, all of the trafficking and the related crimes, 3,000 cases, including a pharmacist, a physician's assistant, and an opioid trafficker, each charged with committing serious drug crimes in New Hampshire. Whether you are a dealer or doctor or trafficker or a manufacturer, if you break the law and illegally peddle these deadly poisons, we will find you, we will arrest you, and we will hold you accountable. Thank you. Here in New Hampshire, I applaud all of the drug enforcement agents and law enforcement officers who recently coordinated Operation Granite Shield, an 18-hour enforcement action targeting drug traffickers that resulted in the arrest of 151 people. These are terrible people, and we have to get tough on those people because we can have all the blue ribbon committees we want. But if we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty. You know, it's an amazing thing. Some of these drug dealers will kill thousands of people during their lifetime. Thousands of people. And destroy many more lives than that. But they will kill thousands of people during their lifetime. And they'll get caught, and they'll get 30 days in jail. Or they'll go away for a year. Or they'll be fined. And yet, if you kill one person, you get the death penalty, or you go to jail for life. So if we're not going to get tough on the drug dealers who kill thousands of people and destroy so many people's lives, we are just doing the wrong thing. We have got to get tough. This isn't about nice anymore. This isn't about committees. This isn't about let's get everybody and have dinners and let's have everybody go to a blue ribbon committee and everybody gets a medal for frankly talking and doing nothing. This is about winning a very, very tough problem. And if we don't get very tough on these dealers, it's not going to happen, folks. It's not going to happen. And I want to win this battle. I don't want to leave at the end of 7 years and have this problem. Okay? I don't want to, right? Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Not going to happen. Thank you all. A lot of voters in this room, I see that. Thank you. No, we're going to solve this problem. We're going to solve it with brains. We're going to solve it with resolve. We're going to solve it with toughness. Because toughness is the thing that they most fear. That's what they most fear. So to the brave agents and officers, thank you for protecting us all. Last year, my commission on combating the incredible crisis of opioids issued 56 recommendations. My administration agreed with all of the commission's goals, and we've worked aggressively to put them into action. Today, I'm here to announce additional steps that we're taking as part of our nationwide initiative to address the opioid crisis, and by the way, the drug crisis, the general drug crisis. First, we're taking action to reduce drug demand by preventing Americans from becoming addicted in the first place. So important. That includes increasing federal funding for the development of non-addictive painkillers. And we have to come up with a solution where we come up with a painkiller that's not so addictive. And we can do it. We're not that far off. We can do it. These things are incredibly addictive. So we're going to find that answer also. Here with us today are Jim and Jean Moser. They lost their beautiful son, Adam, to a fentanyl overdose. His addiction began with prescription pills he found in their kitchen cabinet. They have since begun the Zero Left initiative to help families get rid of excess painkillers. Jim and Jean, we're sorry for your loss. A great boy. He's a great boy. And we applaud your strength and your leadership. And where are you? Where are you? Come on up. Come on up here. Come on up here. Tell us about your boy.
Wow. Adam was our oldest son. He was a great kid. He was a smart kid. Grew up out in rural East Kingston, New Hampshire. He had a degree in actuarial science, which, as many of you know, that's the science of forecasting risk. He was the kind of kid that made you feel really good about yourself. You give him 5 minutes, you really liked him. And, you know, he just made a bad choice one night. As smart as he was, he found his way into our kitchen cabinet, and sadly, the rest is history. He got hooked on it and had to go to the street eventually, and he found fentanyl, and he's been gone for 2.5 years, and we miss him every day. Thank you.
Thank you, darling. You take care of yourself, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. And so many cases like that. We're also taking action to prevent addiction by addressing the problem of over-prescribing. And our Department of Justice is looking very seriously into bringing major litigation against some of these drug companies. We'll bring it at a federal level. Some states are already bringing it, but we're thinking about bringing it at a very high federal level. And we'll do a job. We're going to cut nationwide opioid prescriptions by 1/3 over the next 3 years. We're also going to make sure that virtually all prescriptions reimbursed by the federal government follow best practices for prescribing. We'll ensure that opioid addiction is not subsidized by the American taxpayer. The best way, so important, and the best way to beat the drug crisis is to keep people from getting hooked on drugs to begin with. As part of that effort, so important, and this has been something that I've been very strongly in favor of, spending a lot of money on great commercials showing how bad it is, so that kids seeing those commercials during the right shows on television or wherever, the internet, when they see these commercials, say, I don't want any part of it. That's the least expensive thing we can do, where you scare them from ending up like the people in the commercials, and we'll make them very, very bad commercials. We'll make them pretty unsavory situations, and you've seen it before. And it's had an impact on smoking and cigarettes. You see what happens to the body. You see what happens to the mind. So we're announcing a new website, crisisnextdoor.gov, where Americans can share their stories about the danger of the opioid addiction and addictions. But we're thinking about doing really a large-scale rollout of commercials that show how bad it is for the kids. And when they see those commercials, hopefully they're not going to be going to drugs of any kind. Drugs of any kind. And we'll save a lot of lives, and we'll make their life a lot easier. This epidemic can affect anyone, and that's why we want to educate everyone. The second part of our initiative is to reduce the supply of illicit drugs. 90% of the heroin in America comes from our southern border, where eventually the Democrats will agree with us and will build the wall to keep the damn drugs out. Pretty amazing. They don't want to go with DACA because they don't care about DACA, but they're trying to tie the wall to DACA and DACA to the wall, and they want to keep DACA for the campaign instead of getting it approved, which we could do very easily. The Republicans are totally in favor of doing something substantial for DACA, but the Democrats like it as a campaign issue, so they don't get it approved. And they want to tie it to the wall, which is okay with me. Both should get approved. They don't want it to be approved. Remember what I said. They don't want it to be approved. They want to make it part of the campaign. Well, we'll make it part of the campaign also, and we'll win, because we're going to win on those issues. My administration is also confronting things called sanctuary cities that shield dangerous criminals. And every day, sanctuary cities release illegal immigrants and drug dealers, traffickers, and gang members back into our communities. They're protected by these cities. And you say, what are they doing? They're safe havens for just some terrible people. Some terrible people. And they're making it very dangerous for our law enforcement officers. You see it all the time. As the people of New Hampshire have learned firsthand, ending sanctuary cities is crucial to stopping the drug addiction crisis. And your governor, who is great, the numbers are going down in New Hampshire. I don't know if you've seen it, but the numbers are going down. Chris, we would just stand up, Chris. It's really one of the few bright spots where the numbers actually are going down, and that's a tremendous achievement. Thank you, Chris. According to a recent Dartmouth study, the sanctuary city of Lawrence, Massachusetts, is one of the primary sources of fentanyl in six New Hampshire counties. ICE recently arrested 15 MS-13 gang members. These are not good people, folks, okay? These are bad, bad people. They don't use guns. They'd rather use knives because it's more painful and it takes longer. These are bad people. In Boston, Massachusetts, which is a place where you have sanctuary cities, I'm repeating my call on Congress to block funds for sanctuary cities and to close the deadly loopholes that allow criminals back into our country and into our country in the first place. You know, some things are very understandable. We have lots of issues where we're on both sides of an issue, and you can understand the other side, even though you don't agree. Sanctuary cities are hard to understand for people because they don't get it. They don't get it. You see what's going on in California, how terrible it is, how dangerous it is, and they're all trying to protect sanctuary cities. And whether it's Kate Steinle or so many others, they'd be around today if these people weren't allowed back into our country through, in this case, the southern border, at least five times. And look at the damage. And then look at this verdict. Look at the verdict. Can you believe the verdict? So we have to get a lot smarter. We have to get a lot tougher. And speaking of tough, because here with us today is ICE agent Derek Dunn. Derek worked with state police to uncover a major drug smuggling operation in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Where's Derek? Derek. Where's Derek? Come here, Derek. I love tough guys. We need tough guys. Come here, Derek.
Just want to say thanks for everyone being here, and it's been a battle. It's been an absolute battle for our counterparts here at DEA and FBI and everybody, all the law enforcement, state police, and the local police. It's been an absolute battle. We all work together, and we're going to get this solved.
Thank you. He didn't know he was going to do that. And you didn't know you were going to do that, but that's in honor of your boy, right? It made a big impact. I also want to mention ICE agent Ron Morin and Manchester police detective Patrick McGuire. They helped lead the team that arrested a terrible human trafficker who used opioids to harm, in a very violent way, his victims. Thank you both for bringing the trafficker to a very strong and swift justice. Where are you guys?
Thank you.
Stand up, Harry. Thank you. We're also shutting down illegal online marketplaces and preventing drugs that come from China and other countries from bypassing our borders, and we're getting very tough on it. It's not that we have a choice. We don't have a choice. We can be nice, and we can be soft and weak, and you're not going to have a country left. So we have to strengthen up and strengthen up our laws so that we can do what we have to do. We have to stop this from happening. Drug traffickers kill so many thousands of our citizens every year. And that's why my Department of Justice will be seeking so many much tougher penalties than we've ever had. And we will be focusing on the penalty that I talked about previously for the big pushers, the ones that are really killing so many people. And that penalty is going to be the death penalty. If you look at other countries, I've gotten to know the leaders of many countries. And I won't mention names, but you know the countries I'm talking about. I go around, how's your drug problem? We don't have much of a drug problem. What do you mean you don't have a drug problem? Well, we don't have. I say, how come? We have zero tolerance for drug dealers. I say, what does that mean? That means we have the death penalty for drug dealers. We don't have a drug problem. Take a look at some of these countries where they don't play games. They don't have a drug problem. We have court cases that last 10 years, and then they get out at the end. We got to be tough. We have to be smart. We have to change the laws, and we're working on that right now. The Department of Justice is working very, very hard on that. But the ultimate penalty has to be the death penalty. Now, maybe our country's not ready for that. It's possible. It's possible that our country is not ready for that. And I can understand it, maybe. Although, personally, I can't understand that. But there are people that are good people, that are strong, smart people, and they would differ with most of us. But I think unless you do that, unless you have really, really powerful penalties, led by the death penalty for the really bad pushers and abusers, we are going to get nowhere. And I'm telling you, we are going to get somewhere. Companies must also be held.
From 90.9 WBUR in Boston, you're listening to a special Radio Boston. It's coverage of President Donald Trump's speech about combating opioid addiction. He's speaking in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Bad actors that harm our citizens. And I can tell you that Jeff Sessions, who's here with us now, feels so strongly about this. And they're working very hard and very effectively on that. And so we appreciate that very much. Thank you. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you. I can think of nothing more important. The third part of our initiative is to get life-saving help to those who need it. We're going to make sure our first responders have access to life-saving, overdose-reversing drugs, which, by the way, are amazing. Here with us today is Mike Kelly, the president of Adapt Pharma. Adapt Pharma makes an overdose reversing drug for opioids, which I've watched and seen work. It's called Narcan. It's actually incredible. Today, we applaud Adapt Pharma's decision to provide free Narcan to all high schools, colleges, and universities in America. I'd like you to come up, Mike. Come up. Where's Mike? Come up, Mike. That's really an amazing and generous offer. Thank you. Tell us a little bit about that, Mike, please.
Sure. So Adapt is a small company that has a big job, which is to reverse overdoses. And we've provided free of charge 4 boxes to all colleges and universities in the United States. 2 boxes free for every high school in the United States, as well as educational awareness for the nursing departments, as well as the faculty, to train and teach everybody about the dangers of opioids and the risks, and also the benefits of having Narcan nasal spray near where opioids are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mike. It's amazing, generous. And I've watched the police and the fire. They come around, and they've become so good at it. But I've seen people that are just about dead wake up. Now, the problem is they then go back in many cases to the drugs, and they do it again and again and again. But we have to work on that. We have to work on that very, very strongly. I also want to recommend and commend a Richmond-based company, Kaleo, for donating more than 300,000 doses of their overdose-reversing drug to first responders, which has already saved more than 5,000 lives in a very short period of time. My administration has made clear that medical providers can share crucial information with family members about an overdose so that their loved ones can help them get into treatment. We need treatment. We're making medically assisted treatment more available and affordable, and we continue to increase competition and drive down drug prices. And we're driving them down. We're going to have a major news conference, probably at the White House in about a month, because all of you people, and I'm talking about prescription drugs, not necessarily the drugs that we're talking about here, but we pay as a country so much more for drugs because of the drug lobbies and other reasons and the complexity of distribution, which is basically another term for saying, how do we get more money? And if you compare our drug prices to other countries in the world, in some cases, it's many times higher for the exact same pill or whatever it is in the exact same package made in the exact same plant. And we're going to change that. And I would like to ask Secretary Azar just to come up and mention opioid, but also talk about how we're getting your drug prices down, and we've already saved billions of dollars for our country, and it's reflected in much lower drug prices. Watch what's going to happen over a short period of time. This man is one of the great professionals, ran an incredibly successful drug company. Who knows better than the guy running the drug company, Eli Lilly? And that's your company, right? Or was. Now you're on the other side, though. So nobody knows better. The most respected man in that industry, and we got him to work because he loves our country. Would you tell them a little bit about what you have planned for drug prices and also opioids in terms of stoppage, please?
Secretary.
Well, thank you, Mr. President. And, you know, you've done a lot already to tackle this issue of drug pricing. So last year, the FDA approved more generic drugs than it ever has in its history. And that brings prices down for patients, for the system, for everybody. You also changed the rules so our senior citizens pay less out of pocket for their drugs. That's $3.2 billion that they're paying less out of pocket for their drugs when they go to the when they go to the pharmacy. And then we're going to be rolling out, as you mentioned, in about a month, a whole slate of other proposals around how we decrease the price of drugs and how we bring discounts that the middlemen right now are getting, how those will go to our patients, to individuals. Now, we're attacking this with the same level of action, determination, and resolve that you're bringing to the opioid crisis. And that's where we're focused on prevention and getting that one-third fewer illegal opioid prescriptions to our people. The second is the stopping the illicit flow of these opioids into our country. And the third is compassionate treatment for people, evidence-based, science-based, compassionate treatment that can help people recover and stay away from relapse. So thank you, Mr. President, for your leadership.
Thank you, Alex.
You'll be seeing drug prices falling very substantially in the not-too-distant future, and it's going to be beautiful. And I want to thank also Scott Gottlieb. Scott is working on different things, but one of them is called Right to Try. Do you know what Right to Try is? These are for people that are terminally ill, and there are very, very good-looking combinations of things or pills, medicines, potential cures, and they're terminal, and they're not going to be living much longer, and we don't have the right to give them these experimental drugs or these early-stage drugs that really show promise for whatever reason. But they say because they don't want to harm somebody, if you can believe it. They don't want to harm. So the people will oftentimes go to foreign lands, foreign countries. They'll do anything. They want hope. They want hope. Right to Try. So we're working with Congressman Greg Walden and numerous other senators and congressmen. And I think we're going to have good luck. The Democrats have been pushing back on it, but I think many of them are also coming along. It's called Right to Try. A patient is terminal. There's good progress made with a certain drug. We're going to make it possible for that patient to get that drug. And maybe it's going to work. It's hope. It's incredible. They've been talking about this for years and years and years. We're going to get it approved. So important. To further expand treatment, I'm also calling on Congress to change the restrictive 1970s-era law that prevents Medicaid from paying for care at certain treatment facilities with more than 16 beds. It's such an important factor. In the meantime, my administration is granting waivers to states so they can help people who need treatment now, Governor. We're also going to help inmates leaving prison get treatment so they can have a second chance to become productive, law-abiding citizens. And what we've really done for the inmates, you know, it's very hard for them to get out of jail and get a job. What we've really done for them, better than anything we can sign, any legislation that we can pass demanding that you hire, we're getting a great economy. It hasn't been this good in many, many years. Some people say it's never been this good. And what's happened is, as you see, unemployment is way down, and people are starting to hire inmates. And the results are incredible. Some of these employers are calling up saying, wow, what great people. We're giving them a second chance. It's very, very important. So the tremendous economy is helping us very much with that program. We want every American, thank you. We want every American to be able to reach their full God-given potential, and we will succeed together as one people, one nation, and one great American family. Because Americans never give in, and we never, ever give up. This group never gives up, right? Never give up. Your boy. The brave families here today remind us that the strength of America is found in the heart of our people. We see America's heart in the parents who won't accept addiction as the fate of their children. And if something horrible has befallen that family, they go around and they want to make sure it never happens to another family. And that's why we thank you so much, and we thank your boy. He did not die in vain. We see it in the sons and daughters who cheer on moms and dads as they recover. We see it in the doctors and nurses who provide constant and loving care. We see it in the heroic law enforcement officers who race into unimaginable danger. We see it in EMTs and firefighters who act so quickly to save so many lives. And we see this American heart in the men and women who fight every day to help rescue their fellow citizens from the grips of addiction. These are the courageous souls who remind us that for America, there is nothing beyond our reach, nothing at all. Nothing. We will defeat this crisis. We will protect our beautiful children. And we will ensure that tomorrow is better, brighter, stronger, and greater than ever before. Because as long as we have trust in our citizens, pride in our country, and faith in our God, we will not fail. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Together, we will end the scourge of drug addiction in America once and for all. We will win. We will beat it. We'll be tough, we'll be smart, we'll be kind, we'll be loving, we'll do whatever we have to do, but we're going to win. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was President Donald Trump in Manchester, New Hampshire today, speaking about and presenting details of his administration's initiative to stop opioid abuse. The president was speaking at Manchester Community College. You just heard him there outline the major tenets of what's being called a three-pronged plan to combat the opioid addiction crisis in the United States. And we're going to go over a lot of what president said with a bunch of really smart people for the rest of the hour. And first joining us is Anthony Brooks. He's senior WBR senior political reporter, and he's at Manchester Community College. Hi there, Anthony.
Magna, good afternoon.
So we just heard the president speak in a rather impassioned way about his administration's ideas to combat the opioid abuse crisis, also veered into what sounded like a little bit of campaign stump speeching there in the middle of it. But overall, what was the mood in the room?
Well, this was a relatively small crowd. I'd say 300 or 400 people. They were invited guests, very, very supportive. You had members of the victim of the opioid community, people who had lost family members. You had law enforcement folks and other invited guests. Meghna, I think what struck me about this speech is, you know, when you see Donald Trump deliver a speech, you wonder which President Trump is going to show up. Is it going to be the one who goes off the cuff and rambles and goes into all different directions at once? Or is it going to be the guy who sticks to the script? And today was very much the latter. He had a message to deliver. He delivered it pretty tightly. But another thing that struck me is we were told yesterday by White House officials that this was going to be a sort of balanced approach that would look at three different areas. First, prevention. Second, expanding evidence-based treatment. And third, stepping up law enforcement and drug interdiction, including imposing the death penalty. Donald Trump spent a lot of time talking about interdiction, talking about being tougher, talking about the death penalty, talking about clamping down on drug dealers, sanctuary cities, you know, building that wall. He even elicited a cheer here in the audience, build that wall. So that was very much where he put the focus today.
Right. And that was interesting because, I mean, if we can, let's just fact check one or two quick things here quickly before we dive into some of the other sort of more treatment-based aspects of the administration's plan. I mean, the president did go out of his way to say sanctuary cities such as Lawrence, Massachusetts, are a major cause of the trafficking of fentanyl in New England. And he pointed to a 2016 report partially by Dartmouth University. I actually have that report here in front of me. And indeed, it does conclude that Lawrence is a major hub of fentanyl trafficking in New England, but not because it's a sanctuary city per se, but because it's located around many highways and fast food restaurants, which makes buying and selling convenient and fairly anonymous. Did point to the fact that some Dominican-based drug trafficking organizations operating in Massachusetts were a major source of fentanyl. But it was interesting that the president there insisted that it's because of Lawrence being a sanctuary city that it has exacerbated the opioid addiction crisis in New England, Anthony.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, another point sort of related to that is when he talked about other countries getting really tough on drug dealers and, you know, suggesting that we don't know how to do that. He didn't say specifically which countries he was referring to, but he seemed to be, you know, moving ever so close to that idea of countries that dispatch suspected drug dealers without due process. And he was pretty, you know, he went right up to that. I mean, I want to be very clear. He didn't say that, but he kept saying, you know, I know other countries that have dealt with this in a much tougher way, and they just don't have a drug problem because they deal with their drug dealers. Well, I'm not sure exactly what he's referring to there, but it does make you ask the question.
Right. I mean, he said those countries that he wouldn't name, but I think we kind of know who they might be. But they don't play games, and he can think of nothing more important than increasing the penalties against dealers. I mean, we were fact-checking some of what the extant law is in the United States about this, because other members of the White House over the past 24 hours of the administration have been saying that the DOJ is seeking to act within federal law that already exists, right? And so in 1994, the Federal Death Penalty Act did authorize the death penalty for certain large-scale drug trafficking cases. Which included the attempt to traffic large quantities of drugs as part of a continuing criminal enterprise. But according to the Death Penalty Information Center, it's a nonprofit center that analyzes the use of the death penalty in the United States. They say the non-homicide provisions that were included in the 94 crime bill against the recommendation of the then Justice Department, no administration, Republican or Democrat, has ever attempted to use that part of the 94, the 94 death penalty bill, Federal Death Penalty Act, Anthony. So I guess, you know, that's my long way of saying, if the Trump administration does indeed decide to do this, they may have a long legal road, a long legal battle ahead of them.
Well, it's true. And as we know, to impose the death penalty in any event takes a really, really long time to carry through from, you know, an indictment right through sentencing. And there's open debate as to whether the death penalty actually is a deterrent. And I think you would hear the same debate here. I mean, it's interesting to note the two Democratic senators, Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, were not at this event. But I was just reading before Donald Trump started talking this afternoon that Maggie Hassan was giving a speech elsewhere in New Hampshire saying the death penalty, imposing the death penalty, promising to impose the death penalty is not part of a plan that makes a whole lot of sense. And this is what struck me about this speech. I mean, they were talking about three areas, as I mentioned, prevention through education and advertising, and other things. They wanted to rein in overprescribing of opioids. They want to expand evidence-based treatment. And yes, they want to step up law enforcement, but by putting so much emphasis and attention on imposing the death penalty, I think it creates headlines. It ends up eating up a lot of airtime among people like you and me who want to talk about it, who will talk about it, and sort of moves away from the strategies that might be more, that are probably more effective.
Right. Well, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and you're listening to special coverage of President Donald Trump's speech in Manchester, New Hampshire today, outlining his administration's plan, his initiative to stop opioid abuse. WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is in Manchester, and he witnessed the president's speech firsthand. Anthony, stand by for just a quick second, because I want to bring in a couple of other people who can get us deeper into exactly that conversation you were just talking about. Michael Botticelli joins us. He is the executive director of Boston Medical Center's Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine. He's also the former director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. He served in that position under President Obama. Michael Botticelli, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here today.
Also, I'd like to introduce Dr. Julia Frew. She's on the line from Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. She's the director for the Center for Addiction Recovery in Pregnancy and Parenting at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Dr. Frew, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I'm going to just ask both of you the same quick question first. I mean, Michael Botticelli, what did you make of the president's speech and the ideas that he's outlined? Some of them seem to actually have a lot of resonance amongst people who've spent, you know, years trying to find a solution for the opioid addiction crisis.
I think some of them do. And I think that, quite honestly, they were significant initiatives that we started under the Obama administration in terms of more widespread distribution of naloxone to prevent overdose deaths, the uptake of increasing access to treatment, particularly under the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. And we should talk about that in a little bit. But also prevention-based strategies. But I agree with Anthony's assessment. And this is, I think, by and large, what we've heard from the president over the past 14 months, and I think underscored by his comments today, is this pivot back to a criminal justice approach to dealing with the opioid epidemic by using criminal penalties and harsher punishments and the death penalty, quite honestly, for drug dealers. And, you know, we've seen he's been referring to the Philippines and Singapore in a number of different ways as kind of heralding their approach to drug issues. Well, in the Philippines, they've killed over 5,000 people, not just drug dealers, but also drug users, and the amount of extrajudicial killings has just been astounding.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think...
But can I just jump in here, Michael, for a second? Because, I mean, I take your point, and Anthony made the same point, that the president's talk about the death penalty sort of sucks all the air out of the room. Everyone focuses on that. But to me, it actually seems the least actionable part of this three-pronged plan, and the other parts of the plan are things that can be done, and many people in the addiction recovery and opioid addiction community have long been advocating for that. So, I mean, I feel like we're spending too much time perhaps talking about the death penalty when the things that can get done that the president has talked about are more worthy of that of conversation.
Sure. I think anything we can do to immediately increase access to treatment, it has to be a priority for any administration as they look at this. I do think, and I feel like I need to point this out, that part of what the president just proposed as it related to treatment was basically revoking a decades-old Medicaid rule that would create greater access to treatment. And while I think that is somewhat important, I can't help but think about the calls that the president has made to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and whose one main provision in terms of the expansion of Medicaid has been one of the ways that people access treatment. So I feel like it's a little bit hypocritical to talk about the value and expansion of role of Medicaid and simultaneously continue to push to look at repealing the Affordable Care Act.
I just want to turn to Dr. Frew here for a moment. I mean, you are there at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, kind of on the front lines of all this. What was your reaction to the president's speech?
Well, I agree with what was said about the importance of expanding access to treatment, expanding access to naloxone, and also working on decreasing the supply of opioids, particularly excessive prescribing after surgeries. I also agree that the stability of Medicaid funding and the Affordable Care Act will be really critical for building an infrastructure of treatment programs that can last. I worry right now that by relying on temporary grant funding in some cases, we may be building treatment programs that won't be able to remain in existence when their funding finishes. So I think that the continued existence and widespread availability of Medicaid to the people who are struggling with opioid use disorders will be critical for helping people access treatment and helping treatment programs stay open.
And to that point, I mean, President Trump spent a long time talking about reducing demand by preventing addiction in the first place by, you know, doing things like having the Department of Justice bring federal level lawsuits against some pharmaceutical companies. I mean, and he set a goal of cutting nationwide prescriptions of prescription opioids by a third over several years. Does that seem realistic to you, Dr. Frew?
I think there are some instances where we know we have room to cut back on how much medication is prescribed. So, for example, one of my surgery colleagues here at Dartmouth-Hitchcock has done some work looking at how many pills individual people are prescribed when they leave the hospital after surgery. And this is not unethical doctors, you know, running pill mills. This is just simply, you know, after someone comes in for a routine procedure, whether they are given a prescription for 30 pills versus 10 pills. And he's been able to show that by carefully determining how many pills people need based on what they use in the hospital, that we can decrease the number of pills prescribed by about 40% in that specific situation. So I don't know about cutting by large percentages across the board, but I think there are some situations where there might be some low-hanging fruit and a way to make some headway.
Michael Botticelli, jump in here.
I would absolutely agree. I think there is lots of opportunity to reduce opioid prescribing, and I have to say that Boston Medical Center is following the lead of Dartmouth-Hitchcock in creating a post-surgical opioid prescribing goal. So I think there's lots of opportunity to do that. I also think we heard the president talk about prevention efforts, right, by the creation of this large-scale information campaign. And I would hope that and he talked a lot about scaring kids.
Well, through he wants a national ad campaign.
A national ad campaign. Well, one of the things that I hope he does as he creates this campaign is really turn to prevention experts and public health experts on the creation of those messages. One of the things we've learned over the years is that actually scaring kids does not work in terms of an overall prevention messages. And, you know, I know that there are a significant number of prevention experts within the administration and outside the administration. And we should be sure that we're bringing the best evidence standards around creating that campaign. So while I think he was being a little bit kind of hyperbolic in terms of what the campaign is about, I would hope that we not waste taxpayer dollars by creating, in essence, scare tactics that we know don't work in preventing substance use among youth.
I mean, the president said that previous such anti-drug addiction or drug use campaigns, ad campaigns, had worked, and I didn't know if that's necessarily true or not. I mean, those Your Brain on Drugs ads, were they effective?
They weren't, and Just Say No was not a particularly effective campaign. And again, I think, you know, we have to implement kind of what we know to be effective prevention messaging and public health messaging as we relate to these campaigns. I think, you know, we have seen kind of highly successful campaigns. Above the Influence was a campaign that actually was proven to work. So we do have standards in terms of what any sort of campaign, public information campaign, should look like. Yeah.
Anthony Brooks, you're there in Manchester, and I just wanted to ask you, I mean, because I know you got to go do a bunch more reporting on the president's speech today, but what's the significance of the fact that the president did come back to New Hampshire in order to give this speech, to unveil his initiative? Because it wasn't that long ago in an early call, maybe a year ago, in an early call that he had with the Mexican president, he infamously called New Hampshire a drug-infested den.
Yeah, and I'm sure that had something to do with it. I mean, there's always a political context. Anytime a president leaves Washington and comes to whether it's New Hampshire or Iowa or California, there's going to be sort of a political background. So, I mean, a couple of things. There was a poll just out of WMUR recently that shows President Trump really unpopular in New Hampshire. I think his approval rating is something like 36% according to that poll. So I think that had to be a consideration in part of the White House in coming back here. There was also a promise. I mean, this is where, after all, he started. He had his first primary victory here in New Hampshire. That was a big deal. He made reference to that today and, you know, talked about, I don't want to leave at the end of 7 years and have this still be a problem. Interesting that he said he didn't want to leave after 7 years rather than after 8 years, but that's what he said. So clearly he's got political work to do here, and New Hampshire is a place where it has to start. But, you know, I don't want to sound cynical about this because they also made a promise that they would come back to New Hampshire. Yesterday in briefing us reporters, Kellyanne Conway, the president's chief advisor, said the reason they're coming back to New Hampshire is because New Hampshire is one of the states hardest hit by the opioid addiction crisis. So this is the place, this is ground zero in that battle. So that's why he's here.
I mean, and to that point, I mean, I a really moving part of the president's speech today was when he brought up a grieving mother, Jean Mosier, I believe, because her son Adam has died at two and a half years ago of a fentanyl overdose and had become addicted by taking some pills that he found in, you know, his parents' kitchen cabinet. Right, it sort of drove home the point that this is a crisis that has a very familiar face to it.
It really does, and it drove home the point, and I'd love to hear your two guests talk about this, because the point that she made, too, was how her son got hooked and basically found the pills in his family's medicine cabinet and started taking them and got hooked. And we hear again and again and again that one of the points of access for people who get hooked on these things is through their family's medicine cabinet. And, you know, I thought she brought a real heartfelt story and face to this addiction crisis, and it was quite moving when she came up and made those brief remarks.
Dr. Julia Frew, I mean, let me turn that to you. Was that one of the moments where, I mean, you must see this every single day of families who are suffering like this?
We absolutely do, and I think it is important to make the point that reducing opioid prescriptions after surgeries isn't just because we worry about the person who had the surgery taking too many and becoming addicted. It's also because we know that people tend to keep these drugs around in their medicine cabinets. And so in terms of public health campaigns, I think it is really important to be emphasizing things like the Zero Left campaign that was mentioned during the speech and other campaigns regarding takebacks of opioid medications or proper disposal so that people can get those out of their households so that teens who are at an experimenting phase of their lives won't be finding those when they rummage through the medicine cabinet.
Mm. Well, Dr. Julia Frew is the director for the Center for Addiction Recovery and Pregnancy and Parenting at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. Dr. Frew, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Botticelli, let me just turn back to you quickly. I mean, you can respond to what we were just talking about. And also, I'm curious, what is it that you didn't hear the president say in this plan that you wish you had?
Well, let me just kind of follow up on the previous conversation. Yeah. I think, you know, one of the most difficult conversations I remember having during my time, but these were incredibly important conversations, is really listening to the voice of parents who, you know, talk about what impact this epidemic has had for them. Here in Massachusetts, Blue Cross Blue Shield just released a study that showed 3 out of 10 people in Massachusetts knew someone who died of an overdose. So this is an incredibly impactful issue that we have here. So I think it's really important that their voices be heard and be included, because I think they also point the way towards solutions around this. And they clearly talked about how do we reduce just the volume of prescription pain medications that get diverted and get misused that can start people on their path to addiction and overdose death. I think what we didn't hear, and I was actually in some respects heartened to hear the president's support for Congress's call for additional dollars, because I do think that that's really important. And because I hadn't heard over the past 14 months or even today, and you know, a call for additional resources that states like New Hampshire and Massachusetts need to help support this. These things cost money to be able to implement, and we need
to
make sure.
Is the $6 billion that they're talking about enough?
You know, I don't, because I don't think we've done the analysis to say how much do we need. And I think that that's research and analysis that's yet to, that we have to do, is to say, you know, look at the scope of this epidemic, to price how much it would cost us to make some considerable impact. I think if you look at kind of the money that we spend on the HIV epidemic, and particularly over time, I think becomes really important to
do. Sustained effort.
Sustained effort over time. So, the doctor talked about having a stable funding base to be able to build from. So I think we have to really understand how much is it going to cost, but also understand that this is going to take some level of sustained effort and sustained funding over time.
Anthony Brooks in Manchester, I know you got to get going here, but I wanted to give you one last shot at a less quick thought from up there in Manchester.
Sure. Well, just to follow up on what Dr. Botticelli was saying, I mean, about the funding piece, last January, Senators Shaheen and Maggie Hassan proposed the inclusion of $25 billion for the battle against opioids in the government spending deal that was being negotiated then. The agreement ended up including $6 billion, and they were happy to get that. But that is just sort of representative of the gulf that might exist among the advocates who say we need a lot of money on this and it has to be sustained. They wanted $25 billion, they got $6 billion. Clearly, this is going to cost a lot of money over time.
Well, that's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks in Manchester, New Hampshire, where President Donald Trump just gave a speech outlining his administration's plan for a plan to combat the opioid addiction crisis. Anthony, thank you so very much.
It was my pleasure, Magna.
Okay, well, I want to move now on to another guest here. Peter Shumlin joins us. Former governor, I should say, Peter Shumlin. He served 3 terms as the governor of Vermont from 2011 to 2017, and he joins us today from Putney, Vermont. Governor Shumlin, welcome back to you.
Great to be with you.
So you, I mean, in many ways, really helped put the opioid addiction crisis on the national stage when you gave that State of the State address a couple of years ago talking about how opioids had ravaged Vermont. What do you make of the fact that, the president went today to the state next door and put forth what he believes could be an effective plan to combat the crisis?
Well, listen, this is a bipartisan issue, and I think President Trump has a real opportunity to be a real hero here if he'll follow his own rhetoric and, frankly, drain the swamp. And let's just go to the problem. I mean, we have to ask the question, why are we having this crisis? Why is every 15 minutes, why are we losing a good American to this disease? And what changed? And the thing that changed, as Michael Botticelli and so many others know so well, is that the FDA approved the use of OxyContin, which is the beginning, the gateway to heroin addiction, and we've been passing it out like candy. And what I said to the president's advisors is, listen, if you really want to do something about this problem, let's do the following. First, look at the facts. Purdue, the manufacturer of OxyContin, lied to the FDA about the addictive nature of the pills and lied to the healthcare community and the American public. They said, we've got the first non-addictive painkiller. When they pleaded guilty to lying many years later, after we were passing this stuff out like candy, the FDA never reconsidered the decision. And why wouldn't they? They gave them a $700 million fine, big deal. That was a year where they sold billions and billions of dollars of this stuff. My point to the president is, turn to your FDA and say, listen, team, reconsider the bad data you were given. We should only be passing out OxyContin for chronic pain and for hospice care. If we turn the clock back on passing out these painkillers that bring such tragic, tragic circumstances to so many millions of hundreds and thousands of Americans, we would solve the funnel in and go back to having this not be the national health care crisis that it is. It's that simple.
Governor Shumlin, stand by here just for a second, because, you know, this is obviously an issue that touches the lives of so many people in New England that I am remiss in not having put out our phone number. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are talking about President Trump's plan as he unveiled today to combat the national opioid addiction crisis. And we heard the president's speech in the past hour, and we're wondering what you make of it. Is this the nation moving in the right direction under the Trump administration for combating a crisis which really has hit so many people here in New England? Again, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Governor Shumlin, hang in here for just a second. I wanted to get a quick response from Michael Botticelli. Do you like the idea of the governor's idea of the FDA stepping in here? I mean, the president looked at the DOJ as perhaps the Justice Department as a means to combat the pharmaceutical companies, not the FDA per se.
Well, Governor Shumlin, it's nice to be on a call with you. I have the utmost respect for what you did. And I agree that the FDA has a significant role to play here. And I have to say, I'll try to give credit where credit is due, that I think the FDA under the auspices of the new commissioner has really, I think, taken some significant steps here in the right direction, both in terms of calling for faster development of addiction treatment medications and looking at non-opioid pain management medications, in looking at the standards by which we approve addiction medications. They've always been held to a higher standard than other treatments. So I think he's taken some significant actions. I would say, as I talk to our clinicians who treat people with pain, I think it's really important that, yes, we have to really diminish opioid prescribing, but I also think it's really important to understand that there are some people for whom opioids, either on the acute side or on the chronic side, are really important parts. Yes, they need to be closely monitored. We want to make sure that we're not putting them at risk here. So while I do think that we've really got to focus on reducing opioid prescribing, I am not sure that kind of ultimately taking all of these drugs off the market is going to continue to advance our goals here.
Governor Shumlin, there's one specific thing I wanted to ask you about, a part of the plan that the president talked about, because, you know, if we're going to view this through a public health lens, which I believe, you know, anyone who's looked at this crisis says that we absolutely must do, and the Trump administration is doing, he took a moment or two in his speech today to point out a pharmaceutical company called Adapt that makes a Narcan nasal spray, who's now agreed to give 4 boxes of Narcan to every college and university in the United States and 2 boxes of Narcan to every high school in the United States. Now, does this seem like a meaningful spreading of a very important medication in the battling of addiction, or is there something else going on here?
Well, you know, I call this feel-good approach to a really horrific crisis. And, you know, look at the price of Narcan. Look what's happened to the price. When I was governor, we started passing it out to everyone that would take it. And, you know, the price while I was governor went from $20 a dose to $80 a dose. So, yes, they can afford to pass out some free kits, and they should. It helps a little bit. But here's my point. This is where I kind of disagree with Michael on his assessment of the FDA needing to take action on this before we really solve this problem. We sold 250 million prescriptions of OxyContin in 2010. Now, we all know that there are roughly 250 million adults in America. So, in other words, everybody got their own bottle of pills. You can't tell me that we've got 250 million Americans in chronic pain or anything close to that. So my point is, we didn't have this crisis in America before the pharmaceutical industry lied to the American public and started passing out OxyContin like candy. We simply weren't having this tragedy. And I don't think it's too much to ask for us to stop losing tens of thousands of Americans by revisiting that decision. And I think that's where we've got to go. In terms of the money for treatment, listen, all of that's good. I think that the effort that Senators Hassan and others are making to try and get more resources, all important. But what I keep saying is we got deceived by the pharmaceutical industry, by Purdue, and frankly some of the distributors who send money to the pill mills that got us into this mess. And they have the responsibility, just as tobacco had to after lying to us, to get us out of this mess. And my second recommendation to the president is lock all of the lawyers in a room. Every governor, every commissioner, every local mayor is suing the producers as well as the distributors and others of these drugs. They're running them through the courts much like they have with asbestos, where they just keep dragging it out, dragging it out. I would, if I were the president, get DOJ to lock all those lawyers in a room and not let them out until they have a tobacco-like settlement that forces the people who got us into this mess to pay for treatment so taxpayers don't have to pay the bill.
Well, the president did hint that perhaps something along those lines he's thinking about, because he did talk about the DOJ looking at perhaps at least suing some of the pharmaceutical companies. Governor Shumlin, I got a ton of callers who want to join us, and I'm running out of time here. So I just wanted to tell you thank you so very much for joining us today and for giving your perspective on this. It's always great to hear from you.
Thanks for having me, and thanks, Michael, for your good work. Keep it up.
Thanks, Governor. You too.
That's Governor Peter Shumlin. He is a Democrat. He served 3 terms as the governor of Vermont. I'm going to get to callers here in just a second, but there's one more person I want to just hear from briefly. She's Representative Annie Custer. She joins us from Washington. She's a congresswoman for New Hampshire's 2nd District and founder and co-chair of the Bipartisan Heroin Task Force. Representative Custer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Magna, great to be with you. Thanks so much for your show.
Thank you so much for all the work you've been doing on this. What was your response to the president's speech in New Hampshire today?
Well, I've got to say there were a number of good ideas, but nothing particularly new. These are ideas that Michael Botticelli, as you have on your show, has known for a long time. The president's own Christie Commission came up with most of these recommendations months ago. And honestly, I don't see the sense of urgency with the president that we need to have. We are ready to pass legislation. We have 104 members, bipartisan, half Democrats, half Republicans on our heroin task force, and we need to move forward to focus in on increasing access to treatment. That's a critical goal. I agree with the president, but it's urgent. I don't see the sense of urgency that he has.
Right, and especially he's going to have to lobby Congress on this, right? Because, I mean, the GOP in a couple of it... I just wanted to jump in here and say, like, regarding Medicaid, the GOP, in a couple of its attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also wanted to reach out and put, like, sort of a per capita cap on Medicaid. So that I don't know how that works with increasing access. Yeah.
In New Hampshire, the way people are finally getting access to treatment that they need is through our expanded Medicaid, and yet I have Republican colleagues who want to repeal it. So absolutely, but listen, these bills are teed up and ready to go. We have an entire agenda. He covered many of them, evidence-based research. We need to know. We need alternative pain management. That's a critical important part of this. We need to know who is most susceptible. I completely agree, by the way, with Governor Shumlin about Purdue Pharma and about OxyContin. Listen, we know what is causing this. I mean, we have research a year ago out of the CDC saying that the longer you're on this medication, the higher the propensity that you have toward substance use disorder, and we need to get ahead of it. So I agree on many of the points that he made, but he has these red herrings. He goes off on a limb on, you know, ideas that just are not productive to moving us forward. I have been working for the past 5 years with law enforcement, with frontline healthcare providers. I have yet to hear anyone on law enforcement ask about the death penalty. What they're asking about, they say every time, we will not arrest our way out of this. We need treatment. We need education and prevention. And then we need long-term recovery. We've got to get past the idea that it's a 28-day, one-and-done type recovery. It's a chronic illness. And we need people to have access to treatment and long-term recovery, sober housing, communities where they can be safe and get back to taking care of their families right. and get on with their lives.
Well, Representative Custer, you were so patient in waiting to get on the air here with us, and I thank you so much for your time. I just want to be sure to leave enough time to get a bunch of callers in here because we got a lot of them. Representative Annie Custer, Congresswoman from New Hampshire's 2nd District and founder and co-chair of the Bipartisan Heroin Task Force, thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you, Magna, for your show. Great job.
Okay, so Michael Botticelli, just bear with me here because I want to roll through a couple of calls here and hear what folks have to say. So let's go first to Ed, who's calling from Natick. You're on the air, Ed.
Hi. I just want to let you know I've 33 years in recovery myself, and I think one of the things that we're leaving out of this equation is the addiction is a symptom. Not everybody gets addicted. So if we're not addressing the root cause, if there's not enough support, there's a major problem. The other piece I think that we're missing out on is teaching children at a younger age. We wait too long. We wait till middle yeah. school at the earliest. But teaching children at a younger age to be able to talk about what's going on with them emotionally and giving them ways to deal with their own emotions without kind of being predisposed to finding ways to self-medicate.
Yeah. Ed, thank you so much for your call, and congratulations on your continuing journey in recovery. Keep it up. Thank you so much, Ed. Let's go to Patrick, who's calling from Revere. You're on the air, Patrick.
How you doing? Only thing I see that the issue is, instead of imposing death penalty on drug dealers, which to me is like a subtle attack on minorities, let's find better jobs to help get these drug dealers off the streets, because these drug dealers aren't selling drugs to maliciously kill people. The cost of living a lot of times is high. Sometimes people need to feed their families instead of starving. So it's not like these people are selling drugs maliciously to intently kill people or to hurt other families. But let's find a system to get better jobs out here. Yeah, the unemployment level has went down, but the jobs aren't good-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
If the cost of living in Massachusetts is $1,500 and an average-paying job is $12 an hour, how are you going to pay rent?
Yeah.
$12 an hour, and you're working 40 hours a week, but your rent is $1,500.
Right.
That's why everybody is... Yeah.
Patrick, I just wanted to jump in here and say that I think you're making a great point about sort of the depth and complexity of this problem, and sort of just... hitting things willy-nilly isn't going to really solve it long-term, but thank you so much for your call. Let me get one more in here at least. Peter is calling from New York City. You're on the air, Peter.
Yeah, hi. First, big thanks to Governor Shumlin and Michael Botticelli for being trailblazers in this. I remember when Governor Shumlin dedicated the State of the State, his entire State of the State address to this problem. I really admire both the work and Michael Botticelli. I wish you were heading this up again. I've been sober 27 years. I work in the field in New York. And I admire the president at least shining a light on this. I don't know if the light is bright enough. I mean, I thought we were already exhausted this many years ago with arresting our way out of this. In New York, we had the Rockefeller laws that didn't give any discretion to judges years ago. Finally, years after they were imposed under Governor Rockefeller, we repealed those laws. And now there's a difference. You know, judges have discretion in New York for minor crimes of not being having their hands tied behind their back to mandating defendants to
yeah.
prison. Nowadays, there's an alternative to prison. I'm saying, are we really at a point in this country that the president is saying that we can arrest a way out? Not only arrest a way out, it's amplified, but well, let's execute the death penalty. And as far as scaring kids, I don't know. I mean, I think we should put some money into education, but I don't know if we can scare the kids. But the thing that bothers me the most is just you know, the attitude that we can arrest. This is an
yeah.
illness.
No, when Peter, I'm just going to jump.
Different times.
Peter, yeah. I'm just going to jump in here because I'm running fast out of time here, and I wanted to turn your thoughts back to Michael Botticelli. But thank you so much for your call. I mean, this is Michael Botticelli. This is a part of the president's speech. It's the one that attracts the most attention. There are other proposals that he made around it, but the idea that when he said, you know, we're going to solve this this crisis through brains, resolve, and toughness, and this is the president saying, because toughness is the thing they, and I presume he meant drug traffickers, they most fear. I mean, when that seems to be the emotional center of gravity here, you heard Peter responding to that he doesn't think that that is at all the way that we're going to solve the crisis.
And I would agree with many of your callers, including, you know, Governor Shumlin and Representative Custer here, that I think by and large, local law enforcement has made that pivot, has really come to an understanding that we can't arrest and incarcerate our way out of the population, out of this issue. I also think that while I do think there has to be accountability for major drug dealers, I think what most people don't understand is that there is not a bright line between people who might be dealing drugs as a way to support their own addiction and those other drug dealers. And there's this whole group of people in the middle that I'm afraid will get swept up in kind of this zeal to go back and pick up a drug dealer. So I think it's really important for us to remember that. But by and large, the diagnostics on this epidemic have been done. Mm-hmm. And we kind of know what we need to do here. So I think really the goal of this administration really needs to be, how do we fully implement all of the things that we know to be effective?
Is this a good start, though? I mean, don't you think? Because some of the things that the president talked about that's in the plan, we've talked about before, you and I, this show.
We have. And I do think looking at expanded naloxone distribution, on how do we make sure that everybody who needs treatment gets access to it, how we have good evidence-based prevention programs. But, the proof is in the pudding here. And so what I think is really important for us to continue to look at is then how do these things get translated into practice and into policy? And are they going to be sufficiently resourced? Because I think that that's really the goal here, is to say, yes, we know these things are effective, but are they going to be appropriately resourced and appropriately resourced over time?
I mean, I think this is one thing that concerns me, and that is it's hard with this president or any president, but especially this one, to keep politics out of the picture, right? Because, I mean, while he's talking in an impassioned way about fighting this crisis, you know, he also throws in things like the company Kaleo, right? You were pointing this out to me, that it has an injectable form of naloxone. Is that right?
It's an auto injector.
An auto injector, right? It's the device here is called Evisio.
Yeah.
The device, and that it originally started around $600, and the company raised it to $4,500. I mean, those are the kind of details that don't make it into the president's speech as he's, you know, pointing, as he's drawing attention to what he thinks are certain wins.
But let me say, like, this is where I think it falls short, right? So rather than having executives of those companies come up and talk about the how many doses they're giving out for free, I think would have been a better policy response is to look at, is naloxone on every Medicaid formulary across the United States so that people have access to it? Or making sure that Medicaid has naloxone not only on their formularies, but maybe eliminating copays for naloxone, right? So while I think some of these things are kind of, from a soundbite perspective, sound good, I think some of them fall short of what I think the federal government could be doing if they really wanted to expand access to naloxone and making sure everyone who had needed it got it.
Well, because this is such a crisis that really hits so deeply in New England, I want to sneak in one last call here. Garfield, you're calling from Gloucester. You got like literally 30 seconds before I got to wrap up the show, but I'm going to give you the last word, Garfield. What's your thought?
I wanted to discuss more with methadone. I mean, as far as, you know, all of these other naloxones and suboxones and everything else, I mean, I found methadone really saved me. I've had like 10 years now, with success on methadone. The only issue is that methadone isn't prescribed. It's something that you have to go and take every morning.
Yeah. Garfield, I'm going to take it back from you because you can't see Michael Botticelli, but he gave you a thumbs up in bringing up methadone here. But thank you so much for your call. You got like 10 seconds here, Michael Botticelli. What do you think next step should be?
Well, I think that if we continue to really focus on implementing the science and the evidence, I think we're going to be in a better place. And if that's the path going forward that this administration is going to take, I think we might make more headway.
Well, Michael Botticelli is executive director of the Boston Medical Center's Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine and former director of the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy under President Obama. Thank you so very much.
Great. Thank you, Magna. Good to be here.
We'll keep covering this in the coming days. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.